Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, the weekly libertarian podcast that requires neither reconciliation nor even a parliamentarian. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Howdy, partners.
Why you gotta step on my howdy?
Hey, Matt.
Happy Monday.
I just, you know, there are other words.
That's all I have.
I gotta cycle through the words. We're going to cycle through the words of a momentous week in Washington, D.C. here in a moment. But first, are you finding it harder than ever to keep up with the news? Frustrated with paywalls? Irritated by clickbait? Flummoxed by pop-up ads? I'm flummoxed often. Well, close your eyes and imagine an app where you can access the most reliable news sites. An app that filters out the garbage, yet still presents every story from multiple perspectives. An app where journalists scour through the headlines from around the world to find stories you wouldn't normally see, including actual good news sometimes. All this can be yours from an innovative Australian startup called Inkl, I-N-K-L. Inkl.com has signed partnerships with more than 100 news sources, such as The Economist, The Atlantic, and Bloomberg, and created a unique system combining journalists and algorithms to create a best-of newsfeed. For just $100 a year, this service gives you access to premium news sites that would otherwise cost you $12,000. If you go right now to inkl.com/podcast, they'll give you an additional 25% off. That means you can get a whole year's worth of headache-free news for just $75. That's inkl.com/podcast. Try it today. You'll be glad you did. Okay, this is it. This is it, everyone. After I don't know how many years we've been talking about it. This is Infrastructure Week. It is.
Well, it's like the Smile album finally coming out, you know.
But is it like the Smiley Smile album, though? Like,
this is the long-awaited, 10 years too late.
Chinese democracy.
No. This is not Chinese democracy. This is the Duke Nukem Forever of domestic policy legislation.
I hate you all.
Thank you, Catherine. Congress today is beginning debate on the already Senate-passed $1 trillion with a T infrastructure bill, at least a portion of which may theoretically go towards actual infrastructure. This is being managed as a necessary precursor to the much more wobbly $3.5 trillion Biden omnibus, Biden-nibus, package, which House Speaker Nancy Pelosi acknowledged over the weekend is self-evidently going to be smaller than that price tag, due mostly to objections from Senators Joe Manchin, plus Catherine's favorite, Kristen Sinema. That's the Kristen Sinema woo. Since this is a reconciliation bill, quote unquote, Democrats are going to need every single one of their 50 votes in the Senate to get the big one passed. Meanwhile, President Biden is going around saying all sorts of goofy things. Evergreen tweets. Catherine,
like, what's he saying, Matt?
Thanks, Nick. I wasn't going to get there. It didn't occur to me to get there until you gave me that prompt. Catherine, I'd like you to respond both to the contents of a thing the president said last week and maybe also how it was portrayed in the Washington Democracy Dies in Darkness post. Here's the headline. Biden defends his social agenda bill, saying the cost will be zero. And here is the lead of said headlined story. President Biden promised Friday that his sweeping domestic agenda package will cost, quote, nothing, unquote, because Democrats will pay for it through tax hikes on the wealthy and corporations, comma, a show of confidence despite the struggles of congressional Democrats to bridge internal divisions on myriad issues. How you like them apples, Catherine?
I do not like them apples. I would prefer different apples. I would prefer a pink lady or perhaps a Honeycrisp. So here's the thing. Everyone is being purposely obtuse, like really, really, really choosing to not understand each other. The idea of gross and net costs are now a thing that all of Twitter is really, really mad about, I guess. You know, this is something that Glenn Kessler, who I really like, he jumped into the fray and said, do people not understand gross cost versus net? $3.5 trillion is before tax increases and fees. Trump's gross tax cut was $5.5 trillion before other tax increases, etc. Reduced it to $2 trillion in net costs, i.e. higher deficits. Like, no, Glenn, people do not understand that. This is a widespread problem in our discourse about not only government spending, but also there's an astonishing number of journalists who really don't even understand the difference between revenue and profit in the private sector. Like, this is very simple math and a very simple idea that people really, really struggle with. That said, you can and should make a case for your legislation, which is that this legislation, we have considered how much the things we want to do in this bill will cost and have found ways to pay for them within the existing budget. That is like a totally reasonable thing to say. It is not reasonable to say, therefore, this costs nothing. Therefore, zero. That is wrong. It costs whatever it costs. It costs $3.5 trillion or whatever it's going to be. That is the cost. It's because money could be used for other things. Or debt is debt. Those are both like real points. So I guess I am just, as always, astonished at people's deep, deep commitment to talking past each other, to being willfully obtuse, and to do all of that somehow in the service of spending ever-increasing amounts of money for things, for the most part, that I do not think we should spend that money on.
Peter, I see a lot of Democrats getting super big mad at Manchin and Sinema. Whether it's Paul Krugman writing open letters to Joe Manchin about coal in the New York Times, which I hear plays real big in West Virginia. I think Josh Marshall is out there writing conspiracy theories about how Sinema is just trying to be an independent all along. It's part of her master plan. You hear a lot of comments along the lines of this week, above all, proves that we need to get rid of the filibuster and allow democracy to thrive in lightness. Is that true?
Well,
you made him speechless, Matt. You finally did it.
Let's try this. You wrote an article about this 3 days ago. Would you like to talk about it?
Then you asked a question about the truth value of a statement that I was trying to assess.
Fair enough.
And what I would say is, when this year started, when it became clear that Democrats had exactly 50 votes in the Senate plus the White House, which means they have the tiniest possible Senate majority, which is 50 votes in the Senate plus a tie-breaking vote from the vice president, there was just a whole lot of progressive discourse about how this proved that this was the time, right, where we really needed to get rid of the filibuster so that we could pursue the Democrats' agenda, because otherwise obstructionist Republicans are going to get in the way. And now I think it is actually fair to say that Republicans have acted in obstructionist ways and have at least exploited procedural rules in the Senate in order to either advance their agenda or block the Democrats' agenda, because that's sort of how politics works. Parties do that. And so in some ways, that is a fair charge against Republicans. But if you look at what is going on with the reconciliation bill right now, getting rid of the filibuster would not help them put together the votes for this particular reconciliation bill, because this reconciliation bill can pass with 50 plus one, right? That's the whole point of doing this, all this stuff through reconciliation, is that it routes around the filibuster. But their problem is not that they need a bunch of Republican votes. It's not that Republicans are being obstructionists. Their problem right now is that Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema are saying, we're not going to vote for this unless, well, it's not actually clear what they want out of this. Maybe if it's a smaller bill, maybe if they just delay, maybe if inflation calms down, it's genuinely somewhat unclear what the demands are. And I think there's good reason to suspect that while Sinema and Manchin are out front on this and are willing to take the heat from progressives, from sort of Democratic allies in the media, I think there is good reason to suspect that there are at least a handful and perhaps a couple of handfuls of Democratic senators in the Senate who are also uncomfortable with this package. And so right now, their problem is not procedural chicanery, and it is not obstructionist Republicans. Their problem is that they can't get their own party to agree. And the reason they can't get their own party to agree on this package is because it's too big, too progressive, and progressives, the Democratic left, has asked for too much. And it is, I think, a symptom and a telling symptom of the way that the progressive faction in the Democratic Party has just come to think of the Democratic Party as their own, as their vehicle, as a thing that they kind of own and can do whatever they want with. And they don't really recognize that there are centrists, that there are moderates, that there are people who are not Republicans, certainly not libertarians, but are not sort of whole hog, let's just spend all the money, let's, you know, sort of build a what the New York Times called cradle to grave welfare state. And try to push that through on the slimmest possible majority.
Nick, let's pick it up from there. You've got a brain almost as big as your hair. Let's assume that.
Thank you, Matt. But I got a cut.
I see.
So I'm working at a.
Well,
I mean, my brain. I got that cut. This
little trimming.
We know what you do on the weekends.
On the stem.
Yeah. You know?
So let's help us wrap our minds around the size, assuming that Biden gets what he wants, which he won't, but he's the president and he's asking for it and making his Mr. Magoo style statements in favor of it. A $1.2 trillion infrastructure package plus a $3.5 trillion social everything bill. How big is that? What's the significance of ratcheting up federal spending in such a large way?
Well, you know, the important thing, Matt, and I see this in a lot, it's like, you know, that's $3.5 trillion and $1.2 trillion over 10 years. So it's really nothing when you look at it. You know, this is one of the lines that is being kind of perpetuated throughout the media by supporters of Biden, that it's like, you know, so it's like $350 billion extra a year. And come on, Matt, you know, we spend that on, giving billionaires tax breaks every year.
So I mean, that's my monthly vermouth
bill. We can't afford not to spend this much money because it really is a drop in the bucket and it will cover everything. You know, we're going to be able to tax the poor by the end of the, you know, everything is implemented, et cetera. So, it's a massive increase in the amount of spending, and we are already spending, you know, we have back-to-back years of spending basically $6 trillion, which is up 50% in terms of federal spending from a few years ago. And it keeps going up and up, but we are now in a place where the Overton window is now kind of like, you know, either like a sliding glass door or an open air veranda where you can just like it doesn't matter because you don't have to pay for it. And that's why it's important that Biden keeps talking about how this is zero. This doesn't cost anything. Catherine is right that, you know, there is always a cost, even if you want to come up with some kind of BS math to, show that, you know, when you factor in this and this and, you know, and then that, you know, that Bitcoin mine pays off. Like it really, we end up making money. You know, the worst thing we could do is not massively increase spending. The real cost, I think, ultimately with Biden, who is, you know, and it's worth pointing out, he is doing exactly what he said he was going to do. He was not hiding the ball when he was running for president. The Washington Post said that he was running as the most liberal candidate that the Democratic Party or any party has put up. And, you know, he was talking about $11 trillion in new spending. He is pushing for that. You know, he is in his feeble way, you know, going as fast as his rascal scooter can take him, you know, across that line. So it's, you know, it's not like he's doing something unexpected, but it, you know, the real cost of this bill, I think, goes to that cradle to grave stuff where Biden is looking forward to a world where the government is involved in every aspect of our lives. And they, you know, they might be like, hey, it's okay. Yeah, you can do that. But they are watching and they have, you know, they're holding in their back pocket. Yes, you can do this. No, you can't. And
so it's actually more than $3.5 trillion. And we should just note this, that $3.5 trillion number was only arrived at through basically budget gimmicks where they take programs, in particular, the expanded child tax credit that was included in the $2 trillion bill that they passed earlier this year as a one-year program. So they want to expand it. They want to extend that out to 2025. But they have been explicit that when they say they want to extend it to 2025 as part of this legislation, when we get to 2025 or so, they're going to try and extend it again and extend it again. And that is a temporary program as written in the legislation, but it is being explicitly conceived of as a permanent expansion of the American welfare state. And it would be quite expensive, but that cost isn't recorded in the $3.5 trillion calculation because they have written it in a way that says, oh, it stops in a couple of years.
This is also why this whole conversation is so incredibly dumb, is because everybody has a way to explain how this bill actually costs either twice as much as the number people are saying or actually costs zero. And those people aren't wrong, either of them, right? Like, I could also tell you a story about how when you think of the costs, the invisible costs, the unseen costs of this bill to, you know, innovation and industry, that then really it's actually a bazillion dollar bill. And that would not be wrong. But we have lost the ability to have a reasonable conversation about these bills because they are so multifaceted and all encompassing, and because they do contain so much trickery on the numbers side of things.
The infrastructure bill is $1.2 trillion with $550 billion in new spending. And so the rest of it is repurposed spending from that $6 trillion worth of stuff that was passed as pandemic emergency spending. So in some ways, we're not counting that money as new spending. On the other hand, that's money. That's spending. And we are going to spend it. And so what they have done is pretend that the cost is lower by saying, oh, instead of spending the money on the thing we were originally going to spend it on, we're going to spend it on something different. And suddenly what that means is, we're not actually spending it at all.
I think it's, once you have to do some kind of accounting of what's being proposed and how much it's going to cost. But this is, once you start getting into the balance sheet or the balance, the line items and this kind of stuff, you end up getting lost. And the overall import of something like this is, when Biden, again, saying it openly, that he wants to transform the American welfare state, and that, what this is really about is, take pandemic, everything in the pandemic, where everywhere you go, somewhere the government is forcing you to do this or that. And it's like, we are now all the two-year-old kids. If we come out of this, with everything getting passed the way that Biden wants and the Democratic Party wants, we are going to be the two-year-old who is having their face mask adjusted forever, whether it's on the playground or a flight or in school or whatever. And that's the bigger picture here, is that we are going through, there is an attempt to radically shift what the government is going to be doing to us on an everyday basis, what they have oversight on, they are inserting themselves into every aspect of our lives. And we should be having a debate about whether we want that or not, rather than worrying about
Catherine, speaking of radical insertions, one of the ways that Biden is insisting that his new spending will pay for itself is by giving the IRS an extra $80 billion over 10 years, of course, in enforcement money. This obviously is in the infrastructure bill, since surveillance is infrastructure. The administration is also seeking the ability, this is not in the infrastructure bill so far, we'll see if this gets in this week, seeking the ability for the feds to track not just every financial transaction, $10,000 and more, but everyone $600 or more. And here is President Magoo's quote, this will give the IRS the resources it needs to keep up with the lawyers and accountants of the super wealthy. It would ask just for two pieces of information from the banks of these folks, the amount that comes into their bank accounts and what amounts go out of their bank accounts. That's it. It's not
just
much,
two.
Catherine.
Just the two.
He says that the IRS currently can't see what they're making and can't tell that they're cheating, unquote. So why, Catherine, are you against having the super wealthy pay their fair share of taxes?
Yeah. So first of all, this won't actually allow the federal government to keep up with the lawyers and accountants of the super wealthy. Like, I do actually think that's worth noting. Like, the super wealthy, in fact, will continue to structure their financial lives in ways that evade both notice and taxation. They will do it, for the most part, legally, because there are lots and lots and lots of ways available to them to do that, because our tax code is riddled with, you know, not just loopholes in the kind of traditional sense that people talk about them, but also just, you know, there's a tremendous amount, for something that is so many words, there's a tremendous amount of imprecision. There are a tremendous number of opportunities to change the legal status of your money. I personally would rather have a world where we had a very, very, very simple tax code where compliance was easy. But failing that, and this actually gets us back to the thing we were talking about earlier, this question of whether when you tax people or when you do a tax cut, it makes perfect sense from a budgetary perspective to say that's now money we have to spend or don't have to spend as the federal government. If your point of view is the federal government, then you can treat tax cuts like spending. But if your point of view is a person, then you should not. Tax cuts are not spending. Tax cuts are money that is yours that you get to keep. All of that was a little bit of a sidebar. Sorry, I got distracted in my answer. But the idea somehow, and we've talked about this on this podcast before, that if you give money to the IRS, it magically turns into lots more money, and that is an unambiguously good thing, is absurd. It turns into lots more enforcement and surveillance. It turns into a lot less privacy. It does not, by and large, turn into a lot more revenue from rich people who, again, have tools that us regular schmoes lack to legally evade taxation.
I think it turns into a lot of audits of moderately well-off schmoes.
I want to point out, this was an undercover story, but the Aurora James, the designer of AOC's Met Gala Tax the Rich dress, the New York Post reported she owes hundreds of thousands of dollars in taxes across the country at various levels, including some federal stuff. So, you know, tax the rich, baby.
Peter, you live in Washington. Process question for you. Nancy Pelosi has a quote that was kind of reminiscent of what we heard a lot from Mitch McConnell back in the days when he had power in Washington. It's the following. I'm never bringing a bill to the floor that doesn't have the votes. You cannot choose the date. You have to go when you have the votes in a reasonable time. And we will, unquote. Another quote from the chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, said the members of her group won't support the infrastructure bill until there is ironclad agreement on the reconciliation bill, the 3.5 Biden bus bill, $3.5 trillion. Is this the ideal way for Congress to work?
No.
By the way, you're only getting yes or no questions from that one.
No, it's not. So there is a chicken and an egg problem here in terms of process, which is that moderates want the infrastructure bill to be completely passed. So it passed in the Senate, but it's got to sort of go through a kind of joint House-Senate process and like actually get signed by the president before it's law. Moderates want that bill to be passed before they will do the reconciliation bill. But progressives see that as like a ploy for moderates to get what they want out of the infrastructure bill and then whittle down or not agree to pass the reconciliation bill at all. So progressives have said, we don't want to do the infrastructure bill until we've done the reconciliation bill, which has all the social spending and climate spending, which is what they really care about. And so it's totally unclear how this is all going to work out. Most people have assumed up until very recently that basically at some point they pretty much pass all of it, because no Democrat will get any legislation passed unless all the Democrats, or nearly all of them, all the Democrats in the Senate and nearly all the Democrats in the House, agree on a set of things they can pass together. And so this is an all or nothing proposition. And the assumption has always been that Democrats will, in the end, choose some sort of ugly compromise that doesn't have everything everybody wants. No one will get everything they want, but everyone will get something they want out of this, and they will just agree to go ahead and spend the $4 trillion or so. But it's actually become a little less clear whether that is how this is going to play out over the last couple of weeks, in particular because Manchin has signaled that he's just he's not sure where he's at on this, and he's not saying exactly what he wants from this. I've said this before, but he is not laying out very specific demands that can be met. And in fact, his the biggest thing that he's been saying right now is we need a strategic pause, which is basically his way of saying, let's delay this until later, until I can sort of figure out whether I think this is a good idea or not. Because he's not, Joe Manchin is not a stupid guy. He's not an idiot, nothing like that. But he's also not like a really strategic long-term policy thinker. He is someone who just sort of acts on like a, he has an exceptionally good political barometer that just sort of like is in his body as like an extra organ that he can just sort of feel somehow or another, right? And he just sort of knows where he needs to be at any given moment, but doesn't have like a long drawn out plan. And so, you know, there was a Twitter thread this last week from somebody who had worked with him for a long time who was like, I've followed this guy onto the floor for a lot of votes. And there are times when he did not know walking onto the floor for a giant vote how he was going to vote in the end. And right now, the entire Democratic agenda, or at least the entire Joe Biden agenda, is being held up by Joe Manchin not knowing where he's at and not knowing where he's going to be at. And so everybody's trying to negotiate with that. And it's a difficult thing to do. And in some ways, we should be grateful those of us who do not like this agenda.
So it's a couple of Joes who don't know what they are going to think in a couple minutes. You know, that's the fate of democracy, Matt Welch. One of the backstories or larger stories about this, too, is like, these are the perils of passing major transformative legislation along strict party lines. And you know, both the Republicans and the Democrats have done it. I think the Democrats in the past 20 years have done it more in terms of like the transformation and stuff like that. And you go back to something like the Obamacare bill and people will be like, well, you know, Republicans aren't going to vote for anything. And it's like, that is the nature of Democratic compromise, is that you end up like, if you want to pass something that is big and major and transformative, you really have to come up with a package that appeals to 60%, you know, rather than 50% plus one vote in, you know, the Senate or anywhere or in the House. And it's, you know, it's disturbing that in the 21st century, this has started to become the norm. The early terrible Bush bills, things like the prescription drug plan, Medicare Part D, and No Child Left Behind passed comfortably with bipartisan votes. As did, of course, like, you know, things like the Patriot Act, which were essentially unanimous. But over time, we have become comfortable with the idea that whatever party is in office for however short a period of time is going to cram through its agenda without actually getting a consensus. And what that leads to is, you know, in the next midterm elections, things change because people are pissed off. And then you have an equal and opposite reaction on a bunch of idiots who are outliers in their own party, make it, you know, pushing agendas that actually are quite unpopular.
Catherine, speaking of bipartisan pieces of legislation and also must-pass bills, last week, despite not very much press attention to it, we had one of those. The House passed a $788 billion must-pass National Defense Authorization Act, which matches up with one that's going to be voted on in the Senate in October, I do believe, and will likely go to be signed into law soon thereafter. Among many of the legislative ornaments on this particular Christmas tree is the expansion of the Selective Service System to now include the mandatory draft registration of ladies. So are you psyched about your daughter having to mail in her little obedience postcard?
Oh, my God. I'm going to send her over to you. I'm going to be like, go talk to Uncle Matt about how we handle these things. And then I guess I'll like get her out of jail later or whatever, but it'll be worth it.
Haven't jailed anybody since 1986.
Okay, so then it's fine.
She just can't get a driver's license.
Whatever. Like, we're going to have driverless cars by the time she's eligible for either the draft or a driver's license. No, I want to read you a quote from the always unfortunately named Representative Adam Smith of Washington. The NDAA represents the legislative process at its best, Matt. This year, like every year, we worked for months to identify policies where we agree Where we don't, we engage through in thorough, thoughtful debate on all of them in an era when our politics is so dominated by divisiveness, it has never mattered more to show the American people that democracy still works. If this is democracy working, I don't want it. I mean, this is, it is an example.
Wow, you're saying the quiet part out loud there.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely M team war system except all the others, but I do think that this is precisely the reason that I am skeptical of the notion that bipartisan equals good. Bipartisan often just equals lazily bad and sometimes even pointedly bad, and the NDAA is a great example of that.
All right, we're going to get to our email of the week in a moment. But first, living in a digital age where your personal data is always under attack, you would think that online privacy was a thing of the past. But I'm here to tell you that it's not. Did you know that there is a better way to protect your information and privacy without worrying about the prying eyes of big tech mining and stealing your private information? Introducing Secure, encrypted instant messaging and secure email service hosted in Switzerland, where the world's strictest data privacy laws are in force. By using military-grade encryption methods, a proprietary platform, and servers hosted in Switzerland, Secure protects your data from the invasive Cloud Act and other privacy-violating laws. Your email and instant messaging services will be safe from big tech platforms such as Amazon Web Services, Facebook, WhatsApp, Microsoft, Google. Take back your privacy and online security with Secure by going to secure.com. That's S-E-K-U-R.com. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. Okay, keep these emails coming to roundtable@reason.com. We read every single one internally and get happy. And then once a week, we read one on the podcast and talk about it. Today's comes from Daniel Garrett. He writes a bunch of nice things in the beginning and after that we're not going to read out, but thank you for them. Here's the query part of it. I recently read an article from The Atlantic by Sally Satel, friend o' Reason, titled How Experts Overlooked Authoritarians on the Left. That really made me think. While attending graduate school, it was obvious to me that people on both the left and the right have authoritarian tendencies. At the same time, I can see how left-leaning institutions can develop the blind spot of assuming that only right-leaning people have authoritarian tendencies. My question to you is this. How do we, as libertarian-leaning people, deal with people who can see bad instincts or tendencies in the other side, but can't see those same instincts in themselves on their side? I feel like pointing out the hypocrisy won't be a productive approach, but haven't been able to come up with a way of bringing it up with friends and acquaintances who exhibit this behavior. What do you think, Catherine?
I think the answer here and in so many things is to encourage your friends to take personality and political typology tests, and especially to funnel them in the general direction of the political compass. And I know that this thing is imperfect, but the idea that we are not only aligning points of view on a left-right spectrum, but also on an authoritarian libertarian spectrum, to me, really is the best. Like, people be visual learners, you know? Like, sometimes you just gotta show people the thing you're talking about. And I think that, you know, there are a variety of things out there from the absolute kind of BuzzFeed level, which political candidate as a Disney princess are you, to much more sophisticated versions of these. And I think that is the way. And particularly if you're in a kind of an environment where people are at all open to this conversation, are at all curious about what makes people politically the way they are. And, you know, and I think that's a really important question to lots of people, an increasingly important question, possibly in bad ways, because more things are political than used to be. It is consuming more of our lives. But I think to create a structural way for people to think about authoritarianism as a thing that is outside of the left-right dichotomy is super valuable. Also, on Reddit and stuff, there are a bunch of really, really funny political compass memes. So I guess laughter is the best propaganda.
Yeah, that really worked at Nazi Germany.
Wow. Wow. What's up, Godwin? How you doing, buddy?
That's what Robert Plant was singing about?
Oh, yeah, right. I think so. No, you know what? I think the first thing, and maybe to summarize or paraphrase what Catherine was saying, is like, hey, get new friends. You know? But beyond that, I think what's really important in this, and I find the Sally Satel article in The Atlantic is fantastic, and I highly recommend anybody who hasn't read it, check it out. And also Karen Stenner, a political scientist who was at Princeton when she published a book in the early aughts called The Authoritarian Dynamic. And what's really important here is also to recognize that the definition of authoritarian is not, an authoritarian is somebody like Trump. It's the way that social scientists are defining it is an authoritarian tendency, an authoritarian sentiment is means that people are demanding, people who exhibit that are demanding uniformity or unity along certain serious aspects of life and life experience. So they want uniformity of ideology, uniformity of demographic, uniformity. It could be some studies look at the way that people want cuisine to be the same everywhere they go and things like that. And so that it's really this, and also what's kind of good from a libertarian point of view, although it's not in the political sense, but typically in these studies, authoritarian is opposed by or countered by libertarian, which is somebody who seeks diversity and kind of a range of experience in the same thing. So a range of experience in food, a range of experience in the religion people believe or, you know, whatever the experience of sexuality, it can be across any kind of things. And that makes authoritarian and tendencies clearer to people. Because it's like, are you really the type of person who thinks everybody must believe what you believe in order to count as a full participant in whatever realm of society or politics you're talking about? Or is there room for difference and diversity? And, you know, that to me is the conversation ultimately that we should be having all the time. And to me, you know, I've long talked about libertarianism or having libertarian as an adjective, and it's a pre-political kind of temperament. And I think this research really gets at what, I stumbled into it. I wasn't, reading this stuff at the time when I was starting to think like that. But that's a great conversation to have. Do we want to be more authoritarian? Do we want to, insist on rigidity and uniformity in how we live? Or are we open to the idea of diversity and difference of opinion that we then navigate, negotiate, and also learn from? I mean, I think very few people want to be like, no, I really want everybody to do everything exactly the way that I want.
God bless Sally Satel. She's just the greatest. So, of course, the left has authoritarian tendencies, and of course, the right does too. And authoritarian self-blindness is a symptom of believing that it's not actually authoritarianism if you're correct. It's the idea that, enforcing your values and your preferred practices isn't authoritarian, just a way of building a better society and helping everyone live better lives by doing the thing that you would like them to do. So I hate crappy speakers and vodka martinis, and honestly, I'm not a big fan of cats. And I don't want to prohibit those things, but ultimately, But that's the authoritarian mindset. It's a way of enforcing your preferences, whether it's religion or family formation or martinis or parking requirements on everyone else, because that's your preference. And that mindset is prevalent on the left and the right, because both are value systems that believe they should rule the lives of others.
I would add to these sentiments one way of noticing this all around you every day in the discourse, in people just conversating, including and especially about COVID and the way that people are responding to it. People whose first instinct or whose emphasis in any given communication is about punishing deviants or bad people or people who are presumed to be bad or a political tribe that's presumed to be bad. It's the emphasis of tax the rich over help the poor. If you're advocating just a general punishment against deviants, and especially if you're advocating that government be spearheading that, since government has confiscatory taxation abilities and guns and prisons, that is an authoritarian way of thinking. And it is absolutely on the grow. I could pull out a bunch of studies that I haven't read, but I'm not. It's just anecdotally, that is absolutely on the grow. People want to. Marco Rubio is waking up in the morning thinking, how can I punish you know, big tech companies or academia for being mean to conservatives. And so he's coming up with bills. People all every single day in New York and California are coming up with ways that they think that they're punishing Trump supporters for their inability to come along with COVID restrictions. And then they find out to their chagrin that they've just, you know, alienated a bunch of black voters in their districts, and a lot of conflicts ensue. But this this tendency to want to punish people, it's gross. It's gross. And so to answer the question directly, when people do that, call them on it. Oh, you want to punish the bad person, and you even want to use the government to punish the bad person. That's bad. That's authoritarian. Congratulations. Every authoritarian, actually authoritarian government, as in unfree, heading towards or totalitarian, they always use government power to enforce the behavior of deviant people in ways that are appalling. And so if you're leaning into that now, you're in a bad way.
I also think that there
is, I'm sorry, was something funny?
Just that there is like a danger that this phenomenon the letter writer is describing is going to get worse. And that's because people on the right are, as a excellent tweet from Stephanie Slade this morning noted, increasingly comfortable with just calling their thing authoritarianism. She reviewed...
Yeah, they're just like power. That's what we want.
She reviewed Sora Bamari's new book, Four Reasons, print edition. I commend her review to you. It's excellent. But the responses to her review, as she notes, are not... You know, she basically says, this is thinly veiled authoritarianism. Integralism is thinly veiled authoritarianism. And the response by many conservatives on the Twitter machine was not, no, no, you've gotten us all wrong. It was, yeah, so what? And then she screenshots a bunch of people saying, what's wrong with authoritarianism? And I would say many people retain an intuitive sense of what is wrong with authoritarianism, but if the right starts explicitly identifying with authoritarianism, even a relatively fringy outsider part of the right, that will make it harder to highlight a different but still dangerous authoritarianism on the left, since I do not see the left embracing that term nearly as readily.
Do you guys think that there is an authoritarian dimension to certain aspects of libertarian thought or in the libertarian movement? Because, you know, part of this is also self-critique, and the left needs to police itself. The right certainly needs to police itself. And I have thought about this a lot, because for me, a big part of where the authoritarian mindset shows up is in demographic concerns. And, you know, on the right, you do have people like Tucker Carlson really kind of leaning into the, you know, the great replacement theory, which is, you know, we can't have people who are Mexican, maybe South Asian, and Chinese or Asian, you know, are also problematic because they're not part of what makes America, America. And there's an authoritarianism in that. There's a demographic uniformity that's being demanded. And I see that in some, you know, I remain kind of amazed by how many libertarians who will say the government is absolutely terrible at everything. It can't do anything right. It shouldn't be doing anything except erecting an impermeable boundary around the country, because, you know, Mexicans are going to come in and vote for Democrats. So I do see it in certain dimensions on the libertarian movement.
I think this is what Peter was saying about authoritarian self-blindness, right? People, I think basically all humans have natural authoritarian tendencies somewhere in them. I personally have tremendous authoritarian tendencies. That's why I'm a libertarian. I recognize that my impulses are bad and should be checked, that they should be limited. And I think that,
on the other hand, it's often a good idea to do what Catherine says.
Truth, but voluntarily, my friends. I think that, though, Nick, even though I sympathize with what you were pointing out, which is a frustrating tendency to have blind spots in one's libertarianism, that like debates about so many things, that it's really important to distinguish between government action and sort of private movement bickering or fighting about purity or whatever it is. So I think authoritarianism should probably be reserved for people who want to use the power of the state to compel the behavior of others. And that does, for the most part, mean that libertarians are going to be, at the very least, significantly less authoritarian than their more traditional left-right counterparts.
I mean, the slippery slope to it that I recognize in the rhetoric of certain types of libertarians is using what I have described as sort of negative collective generalizations about populations of people, including populations of libertarians. Once you start on that, that's collectivism. It's a, you know, it's reverse collectivism in the name of libertarianism. It just doesn't, you know, left libertarians are fill in the blank is going to be likely an idiotic statement in general, because you're making a blanket statement about people. And it's also likely going to be used in service of kind of apologizing for some of what right libertarians are backing in terms of limiting immigration or some other types of things. It's a bad look. Shouldn't do it. I would point out also to Nick's point about the weird, creepy demographic interest. We've just seen in the last few days the fourth annual demographic summit in Budapest, at which Viktor Orban said Western civilization cannot sustain itself. We're under attack by Western liberal forces. We need to fight back. Who will live in Europe 50 years from now? Will there even be Europeans? These are the type of things that were said by various leaders there. And the American counterpart who participated was Mike Pence. So congratulations, America. Quickly, before we get to our end of podcast, what we've been consuming, I did want to note the news and elicit reaction from at least Nick. The following: Yahoo News over the weekend published an investigative piece interviewing 30 plus people, concluding that, and I'm going to quote kind of a lot in a second in here, because there is a lot. In 2017, as Julian Assange began his fifth year hold up in Ecuador's embassy in London, the CIA plotted to kidnap the WikiLeaks founder. Some senior officials inside the CIA and the Trump administration even discussed killing Assange, going so far as to request sketches or options for how to assassinate him. Discussions over kidnapping or killing Assange occurred at the highest levels of the Trump administration. The conversations were part of an unprecedented CIA campaign against WikiLeaks and its founder. The agency's multi-pronged plans also included extensive spying on WikiLeaks associates, sowing discord among the group's members, and stealing their electronic devices. Aside from making you laugh, Nick, what are some imports from that?
Oh, it's no, and I'm thinking when they're talking about sketches of how to kill Julian Assange, I am imagining the brain power at the CIA, like calling in Sergio Aragonés, you know, the spy versus spy artist for Mad Magazine. I mean, because this is I rarely get to a point where I say, like, I'm disgusted and you know, by my country. Or by my country's government, more specifically, but in places like when, you know, we destroy Afghanistan or we bomb and occupy it for 20 years, and then we are kind of like, yeah, we really can't take any asylees because, you know, we're kind of filled up right now, or Iraq or elsewhere. You know, this is a moment like that where it is so despicable to see this kind of conversation happening at the very highest levels of government. And of course, it's a place like the CIA. Julian Assange, whatever else you can say about him, you know, is not somebody who should be summarily executed, because what he did was leak, you know, actual legitimate government documents that made a real difference in the way that people view and understand how government functions. And this is a moment where people, you know, who support Trump blindly, or, you know, also, you know, the way Obama acted when Edward Snowden's releases came out, you know, the lying at the very top of government about things like state surveillance and keeping state secrets is absolutely horrifying. And, you know, this is the type of thing that should anybody involved in this, whether it's Mike Pompeo or Trump or whatever, I think they should be by the population, they should just be understood to be beyond the pale of what is acceptable, and they should never have roles in public life again.
Boom. All right, let's get to our end of podcast. What you have been consuming culturally. Peter, do you like to lead us off?
Yeah, I've been reading Foundation, the book by Isaac Asimov. It's a novel, but it's really a series of connected short stories that were first published starting in the 1940s. As I have said in other forums, Asimov was just hugely formative for me as a teenager, but I haven't read this particular book in at least 15, maybe even 20 years, so I'd forgotten a lot about it. But what's really kind of remarkable reading it again is just how much of it is talky discussions about the nature of science and society and political order. There's a a whole big section about how science has been turned into a kind of religion that feels very, very on the nose today. There's not a lot of action, not a lot of deep characterization. It's just debates about how to organize human affairs. And so in that way, it's a lot like the Roundtable podcast. And I'm really, really enjoying it.
Catherine?
I finished the new Sally Rooney book, which Suderman talked about on a previous podcast. And I found it to be not quite as good as her other books, but still one of the better. She's clearly one of the better novelists out there. We are now also entering the Sally Rooney peak fashion season. And so I will be getting out a bunch of like drapey mock turtlenecks to live my best Sally Rooney lifestyle.
What's Dude Rooney Core?
That's a good question. I think it's...
Is it like corduroy blazers?
No, because she definitely hates that shit, but maybe because she hates everything, like actually, which I like about her. As Peter mentioned, the book is interesting. It has a sort of very direct politics, and also it has very direct prose. And yet the book is mostly not exactly about those politics, even though a lot of the coverage wants it to be, and instead about fame and human relationships and how social media facilitates those things. And I recommend it because she's an excellent writer.
Nick?
My consumption for actually the past month has been a thing called Everyday Dose, which is a coffee alternative that's made from non-magic mushrooms. And basically, you take it in the morning, you use it rather than coffee. It has mushroom. It's called the mushroom latte. There's a bunch of things like this. But it's also got collagen, protein, and L-theanine, which is an amino acid, which somebody turned me on to a little while ago. What L-theanine does is it kind of intensifies the effects of other things that you're taking. So if you take 200 milligrams of L-theanine after drinking caffeine, it kind of heightens the caffeine without anxiety, the effects of it. It's supposed to improve focus and whatnot. If you take it with melatonin at night, it intensifies the effect of melatonin and allows you to fall asleep easier. These are all kind of in the realm of like, yeah, it kind of works, kind of doesn't. But Everyday Dose, which is at everydaydose.com, there'll be a link somewhere on the site, I enjoy the taste tremendously, and I have to say I was gifted a 30-day supply by the guy who founded the company. I met him at a party, and I was talking to him, and I really liked it. And I liked it so much that I actually paid for, you know, a subscription to it. So I'm going to be taking it for at least another month, and it's really pleasant. And I noticed, it's supposed to build up over time, but over time, I felt better in the morning. And I don't think I'm sleeping differently or anything like that. So my consumption is Everyday Dose, the mushroom latte.
Is it a hot beverage and does it have
caffeine? You can drink it hot or cold. At the website, they push the idea. You mix the powder. It's like a fine powder. And it comes in a beautiful package and everything like that. It's really a kind of nice ritual, just like opening the canister and shit like that. But you mix it with hot water, and you can either have it hot or cold. They say use it with oat milk. You know, I think they're going for a particular demographic. I oftentimes will cut it with like almond milk or some kind of low carb nut milk, or half and half. And it's delicious warm. It's also pretty good cold. So it might just be. You know, I like the flavor, so it doesn't matter, but it can be hot.
I am heartened to hear that you're buying this directly from the manufacturer, Nick. I would hate that in your never-ending tour, your Bob Dylan-like tour through every substance known to mankind, that you would ever buy black market, because there's a lot of fentanyl out there, okay? I don't want to see a Nick's microdose cut with fentanyl. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Matt. But once again, I do just want to stress that this is not a micro dosing situation. It's an everyday dose, Matt, with a kind of lightning bolt, which in the logo, which might be what sold it to me, because now I'm thinking, like, if I drink enough of this, I'm going to be like a member of KISS. with the
speaking of which, the best Twitter follow in the world, which is obviously a Super 70s Sports, had a phenomenal picture over the weekend of Paul Stanley in like 1977 catching a football in full with one hand in the at the Jets stadium
as the star child or whatever. He had a pretty powerful rock and roll pout.
If you haven't, if you haven't done yourself the favor of listening to Paul Stanley supercut of him saying, "How you doing tonight?" from every city in the world. There's only two that can compete in this. It's the Paul Stanley and it's the David Lee Roth. And those that should be my cultural recommendation. Just seek those out, listen to them, just get your everyday dose on lightning bolts. You'll be happy. My recommendation is also rock based, although no one else's were, which is to say that this has been a few days ago, it was the 30th anniversary, I believe, of the release of Nevermind, the chart smashing record by Nirvana, the great grunge band. Just coughed up an inordinate amount of Nirvanaania out there in the media sphere. Including a super long piece by a biographer in The New Yorker, kind of like revisiting the material for the first time in decades. He's obviously super scarred by the whole situation. Just like a lot of it. Yeah.
That piece drains whatever joy still existed in Nirvana.
Always in those pieces and in most of the things about Nirvana in general, including the great documentary, A Montage of Heck by Brett Morgan, I believe it was. There's 10 seconds put in there about how the band and Kurt Cobain worked their asses off. That's an underlined piece in Kurt Cobain's journal, practice your every day, blah, blah, blah. And there's a sentence like that in the New Yorker piece, but that's not what I'm here to talk to you about. What I'm recommending is, as I do in these cases, usually is Stephen Hayden's list over at UpRocks. He's just a very nice and helpful cultural critic for the Gen X crowd and for the boomers.
How many X's are in UpRocks?
Two X's, which is like one too few. There needs to be a third X, or else what are you even doing? But he's got, as he does in these cases, a list of like the 40 best Nirvana songs ranked. And regardless of whether you agree or whatnot, or even whether you're a super big fan, even if you are, you will see stuff on there that you haven't probably familiarized yourself with. And that's great. And it's just a fun piece of writing as he does those things. And it's give me a lot of feels.
Can I ask you, because Catherine is melting as you continue to talk about Nirvana, but what is your favorite track off of Nevermind?
You know what? I'm going to go out on a limb here and say it's Smells Like Teen Spirit.
It's a genuinely great song.
It's pretty great song.
It's so good. And it's a great video.
Moment over the weekend. Vernon Reed, who's a great Twitter follow, he's the former guitarist for In Living Color, the 80s heavy metal band.
Cult of personality.
He apparently walked into a record store in 1991 that Sasha Frere Jones was at. They were playing Smells Like Teen Spirit.
Peter, can you get the paddles to shock Catherine?
Okay. No. What I'm actually going to do instead is just explain who Sasha Frere Jones is.
No.
He is the where you go when you no longer want to.
There's a lot of places, Nick, that qualify for that. But apparently, so it was at a record store, and Vernon Reed made the comment of like, "Oh, that sounds like REM in the verses and Metallica in the choruses. What a good idea!" And yeah, it's kind of true. But I also like the yeah song, whatever that's called.
There's a 30th anniversary edition coming out in November. If you want to buy it for like the 17th time.
I'm just awake to say, sounds like you guys are old. 30th anniversary editions of anything are bad news, friends.
Except for the upcoming 30th anniversary issue of the Soviet Union collapsing.
Good point.
A fantastic issue, so I hear, and should be pretty good.
The Soviet Union collapsed, Nirvana released Nevermind, and the world was changed forever.
That's my editor's note.
Thank you. Okay. Goodbye. Yeah.